a service that works with everything. Why the Rooney Rule isn't great for diversity in hiring. What Mary Meeker can teach us about tech trends. And there are no new online scams, but we're still falling for the old ones. All that and more coming up on Tech News Weekly.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Tech News Weekly is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Weekly, episode 34, recorded Thursday, May 31st, 2018.
This episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by LastPass. Join over 13 million LastPass users and start managing and securing your passwords today. Learn more at LastPass.com/twit. Welcome to Tech News Weekly. This is the show where we talk to the people making and breaking the tech news. I am Megan Maroney.
I'm Jason Howell. Sometimes the people that we talk to aren't breaking technology. They're fixing technology.
Yeah, true. That's true of our first guest. Now, I have smart speakers. I have smart lights, a smart lock, a smart vacuum cleaner, a coffee maker, even a smart coffee cup because I'm ridiculous. But many of these products are not yet even smart enough to talk to each other. One app that's been working to solve this problem for a long time is If This Then That, or IFT, or you can call it IFTTT if you want. And I just heard that officially from Lyndon Tibbetts, the CEO and founder of IFT, who says it's okay for you to call it whatever you want. Thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us, Lyndon.
Of course, of course. Thank you, Megan. Thank you, Jason. Excited to be here.
You bet.
So for those who haven't heard of IFT, I'm guessing many of our listeners and viewers have heard of it. But tell us a little bit about those that might not. Tell us a little bit about what it is for those who might not know what it is.
Sure. Sure. So what we're up to here at IFT is really helping all your services and devices work better together. You know, we started the company with this thesis that everything was going to be a digital internet service, from your Google Calendar and Gmail account to, like you said, Megan, your coffee cup, your doorbell, and your connected car. And as all of this stuff connected around us, for it to actually be useful, it was going to have to work together. And what we do at IFT is we have these things we call applets. Think of those as little integrations between different things. Could be your BMW and, you know, like say you're going to get your Domino's pizza is going to be delivered and you want to get that update on your Comcast set-top box or your BMW, or somebody is going to ring your front doorbell when you're out driving around and you want to get that delivered to your car dashboard. These are all like real world examples, things that thousands of people are doing. And we have over 300,000 different applets. They've been collectively used over 75 million times. So we just got kind of infinite ways in which things can work together. And we think we're just getting started.
Now, If This and That, first of all, huge fan, been using it for years, has been around for a while. I in my experience and to my memory, If This and That, when I first started to see it, it was at least on Android, like there were things like Tasker that were really nerdy, really, you know, geeky apps that only people who were really passionate about creating macros for things would do. But in that era, this was all very much software based. It was all like, I want this app to talk to this web app, blah, blah, blah. But now we've moved into an era where of IoT, which I'm sure we're going to talk a lot about in the next few minutes, transitioned into this hardware world where the software that you've created now reaches out into the real world. Talk a little bit about that transition. And did you see that coming?
Yeah, you know, I'll say yes and no. We saw it coming, but we thought it was still going to be years and years out. And one of the really exciting things that's happened to the world of IoT has been voice. And we didn't see voice coming at all. You know, people have been trying to do voice interfaces for decades. And I think that's been this huge acceleration for IoT. And I think will ultimately be a huge acceleration for computing in general. You know, we work with Alexa and Google Assistant, and Cortana, and all the assistants are coming. So I think it's been so exciting to see the hardware stuff come along and really validate this idea that everything was going to be a service. And one of the things that you know, is as much as we're known for a lot of the exciting things we do with IoT stuff, your connected doorbell or your connected security camera or your connected blinds, you know, so much of what's happening on IFT today is about connecting those IoT devices to things that don't have any hardware really associated with it. Your Domino's Pizza account or your Weather Underground account, you know, things that aren't really hardware based. And that's something, you know, it's a common misperception that IoT is about devices talking to devices. But oftentimes the real valuable stuff and the majority of what people are doing with IFT is devices talking to pure web services. And I think that just kind of, again, more fodder and more kind of backup to that initial thesis that everything was going to be a service. And we were really just kind of just getting started collectively as an industry, turning all this stuff into internet services.
So IFT has been around since 2010, and it was easy to use then. Well, I didn't use it until 2015, but it was pretty easy to use then, and it's just gotten easier. It's really point and click, and you know, just there's more and more things that you can connect. Do you ever feel frustrated when something that you've made available in IFT is then there's like an app or something else that or the device maker makes that possible? Like I told you before, I used to use an IFT on my Amazon Echo to find my phone. It would make my Amazon Echo would make a noise to find my phone. And now Apple Watch that I wear around, I just press that and that's easier. Does that ever frustrate you when like the great ideas that you've had or that your community has had are then made kind of taken up by the creator of the product?
Yeah, that's a great question, Megan. Actually, not at all. In fact, we have 600 services that are published on the platform right now. We have thousands more that are in development coming. And, you know, we look at it as each one of those services is compatible with every other service. And so if you can think about the use cases, just the sheer number of ways in which those services could work together, it's, you know, might as well be infinite. And in fact, one of the ways that we pitch other services to join the platform is, hey, you're going to get a pretty good inside view about how people want to use your service. What are the other things that people want to do with it that you might not even know? And if some of those folks want to turn and make that actually kind of a native feature of their product, we're all thumbs up. And in fact, what we say is actually we're going to come along and actually help you make that a native feature with IFT. And that's part of where we'll be going next, is not just allowing people to connect things in the IFT app, but hopefully over time, making those same connections as if they were native integrations offered by those services themselves.
Yeah, what you're talking about really reminds me of kind of, you know, we're very used to the Google Home now, but when the Google Home first launched, there were very few limited partners, but IFT was kind of always there from the beginning, to the extent that IFT could fill in the gaps that the Google Home could not quite do yet. And to that degree, like I've always kind of thought of If This Then That as an app that you get that has capabilities that lie outside of what the apps themselves are, you know, allow you to do. And so it's not a hacky way to go about it, but you're really kind of taking the power into your own hands or whatever. But what I realized with the Google Home is that like a company like Google is basically embracing that fact and saying, I mean, likening it to any other legitimate app, like the Hue app or whatever. IFT was right there from the beginning as a solution, as an official solution, to kind of cut those corners and make it happen on your own.
Exactly. I mean, think of what we're trying to do is we want to be, the skills for everything. So, you know, think about Alexa skills, you know, Google Home calls them actions. But we want to do that for everything. So why can't Domino's Pizza have skills? Why can't BMW have skills? Why can't your, Ring doorbell have a bunch of skills that in turn rely on an integration with other services to create that value? So we really look at it as, you know, those kind of developer ecosystems have often been one of the ways in which a platform creates this huge kind of defensible moat. It makes it actually really impossible for someone else to come along. You know, so today, if you're not Google or Amazon or Apple, it's really hard to build a robust developer ecosystem. And that's, you know, they're not doing anything wrong. Those are still great companies. They're not evil in any way. It just, you know, if you're two people in a garage starting the company today, you're not going to be able to say, hey, we work with everything. that's another 10 years off, if that. What IF wants to do is help those two people in a garage starting the company say, hey, if we work with IF, we can say we work with everything. And boy, we're compatible with everything that any one of our customers might possibly use in the future.
So what are some of the craziest or most interesting recipes that you've seen people create, the way that they use IFT?
Sure. I mean, it's one of the things, because it's just so wide open. It's just so varied. So like I'll give you an example. Some of the things that I do, some of them are crazy. Some of them maybe aren't so crazy. So like, for instance, one of the things I love to do with IFT is, again, back to voice. I use Google Assistant, Alexa, you know, I've got them all. But in my living room, I do all kinds of different things. I play video games, watch TV, we entertain guests, I eat dinner in there sometimes, and we have a number of different connected lights, and each one of those lights is actually from a different provider. Some of those lights are just plain old light bulbs and connected to a Belkin Wemo switch. Some of those are from LifeX, some of those are from Hue. I've even got this strip of lights from a company called called Yee Lights. They're really, really sweet, and they're pretty inexpensive. I think you get them for like $30. So I use Google Assistant and IF to set up all kinds of different combinations, essentially scenes across all these different devices that wouldn't normally work together. So like I say, some stuff like, you know, turn on kind of a TV watching mode or projector mode. Other things where it just turn on the lights regular, and that just, you know, the lights as they are. So that's not a super crazy example, but it's one of those things that I think is really illustrative of the power of what we do. So other things that I like to do. So I've got a Nest Cam that monitors my closet. And so one of my cats, we call it Mr. D's conference room, and he sits up in the closet, pretty much all day, every day. But he just camps out up there. And so my wife and I like to monitor that. So we get different notifications, especially if he makes a sound, which is really weird because he's like never makes sound. But if he makes a sound, we get all kinds of different notifications through IFT. That means there might be something wrong. Thankfully, he's never made a sound that was life-threatening. But he's thrown up a couple times. So we've been on top of that right from the get-go with IFT. So those are like some of the things that I'm doing. We see different people. We see people running businesses with IFT. You know, one of the things that we do is help folks, like you said, Megan, add a bunch of stuff to spreadsheets. And add a bunch of stuff could mean anything from new leads to people that are ringing your doorbell to every time you're mentioned in the New York Times. So it's just this huge array of things that you might be able to do.
Well, I love it so much. One of our engineers is here, and he said that he has used it to get a notification for when it's going to rain for years. Now, is it true that was one of the first recipes that you ever did?
Yeah. So I think, some of the first services that were integrated into IFT were Twitter, I think, was number one. Weather was number two. I actually like to say you don't have an operating system unless you have a weather app. So we had to have weather. And then I think SMS was number three or four. So a very, very popular early use case was just, hey, if it was going to rain, or we also had like, if it was going to drop below freezing, you know, go cover the plants. Megan, you'll understand that. That's a very Texas thing. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to go cover the plants if it's going to freeze.
Well, Lyndon, thank you so much. Lyndon Tibbetts is the CEO and founder of IFTTT. You can find it at ifttt.com. But from now on, I'm going to call it IFT because that's what the cool kids say.
It's easier.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you both.
Take care.
Best of luck, Lyndon.
Okay.
Recently, Amazon announced its decision to adopt the Rooney Rule to increase diversity on the company's board. Joining us to discuss this kind of check-the-box hiring for diversity is Jory Ford, Senior Director of Content at the G2 Crowd. Welcome to the show, Jory.
Thank you, Megan.
For people who don't know where the Rooney Rule came from or what it means in hiring, tell us a little bit about that.
Okay, so the Rooney Rule is particularly specific to football in the NFL. It was a mandate that for head coaching positions, a minority would be selected in the candidacy groups for when they were gonna essentially identify who top key candidates would be. And it primarily surfaced because there was recognition that there were limited opportunities for African-American coaches within the NFL.
So according to Recode, Amazon's board is 10 people, all white, only three women. It sounds like they need to do something to increase board diversity. Do you think this is the right thing to do, the Rooney Rule?
I think that if you think about the context of the Rooney Rule, from an NFL perspective, that was specific to employees, right? And it's looking at the coaches. But when you look at a company to the size and capacity of Amazon, you're looking at the board being the key steering committee, driving the decision-making around how their employees, how their executives think about business. So the head of strategy, right? And with the Rooney Rule, I think in this particular application, it's less of a concern because it's more about ensuring that candidates know that there's an opportunity and there's an openness for that business to take on board members. I think board members are unique in the fact that you have to have very unique recruiting strategies for a board member. And when you look at an organization to the size of Amazon, you can actually assume that A, they get a lot of applicants, but B, they may not actually have a lot of applicants who feel confident that they're going to be welcome in an environment that, to your point, Megan, is predominantly white. It's probably going to be limiting for them to get those kind of candidates. So to make a vocal statement that they're going to incite a rule like this to offer that opportunity, I think is the right conversation to have out loud. I don't necessarily think applying it as it relates to the Rooney Rule was the right way to say that to the world. I think it would have been a little bit better to just say we're opening up our practice to ensure that everybody understands we are open to candidates of all colors, genders, sizes, et cetera, ages, and that we'll be applying those methods. I think the Rooney Rule relationship was probably not the right way to communicate that to the public.
Yeah, it's interesting, your last point there, because I'm sure if you would ask anyone on the Amazon board, they would say, well, we've always been open to this, perhaps, you know, and maybe in this, and whether they have or not, I guess we will never know the answer to that question. But maybe by bringing the Rooney Rule into it, it's more of like an official declaration to kind of back that up to some degree. Amazon originally opposed this, from at least according to the Recode article. When and why exactly did they oppose it, if that's the case, and why have they decided to change their mind now?
So I would say that when you think about someplace like Amazon and the when and the why, we don't know what the board was thinking at the time, right?
Sure.
But if you looked at your organization, the direction and the climate within tech and the ability to hire underrepresented candidates, and you realize that your board doesn't really satisfy that, but you also haven't taken advantage of those opportunities, I would say that vocalizing it now would be the most opportune time to do so, right? In terms of the when, I know that previously when they had openings for their board, they had communicated that they weren't going to do that. But part of that communication that has recently surfaced has been that it was because they felt they were already applying those things. So if you look at success numbers and you think about Amazon, which is a data-driven organization, if they were looking at their numbers and success and then looking at the board the same way that Megan just depicted them, they failed. And so then bringing this to, you know, reality and light, especially after the Black Caucus headed down to Silicon Valley, it would make a lot of sense for now to be the time to communicate that more openly.
Tell us a little bit more about the Black Caucus and their trip to Silicon Valley, why they came and what happened.
So I think the Black Caucus had established earlier on, you know, helping businesses better understand one, diversity within the strategy, but two, ensuring underrepresented groups have that opportunity. And many of these larger organizations, PayPal, Facebook, Google, Uber, you name it, you know, they made declarations that they were going to be more driven towards these numbers and creating supportive environments to include. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that putting forth initiatives is going to actually help with that. I think the mistake in, you know, what really occurred is once you make people numbers, it's hard to recruit them. So prior to, they're, you know, mandating, hey, we're going to meet numbers and make a quota, right? And then you don't meet the quota. And behind the scenes, when you look at law and business, realistically, if the caucus is going to hold them accountable, how do they not go down there and help them understand, hey, you didn't make this happen. You tried really hard. You put out your numbers, and we're going to give you an opportunity to explain what you did, how you did it, when you did it, and then give you advisement on reaching out to these communities that clearly they're not really doing well with. I mean, one of the responses from many of the organizations has been the pipeline is thin. And if you look at many of the conversations back and forth, the Black Caucus has made statements like, if the pipeline is thin, then help establish pipeline in your community, support community initiatives around helping underrepresented youths and STEM programs build your pipeline so that you can have it, because that's how we got the companies in the first place. So I think the Black Caucus going down to Silicon Valley was a reminder, this should still be top of mind, and then B, helping them put in place better practices, because if you're not successful, it's not always because you didn't try, and there's not always excuses that you can make, but it may be that you didn't have the perspective of people who represent those groups helping guide you towards how you can better improve your practices.
Sometimes when stuff like this is happening behind the scenes, it's easy to look at it and wonder, or question rather, whether this is about considering hiring in this capacity, or actually hiring with diversity in mind.
Right.
And I think there's a lot of difference between there. What would you say as far as what we've learned over the past couple of years with companies committing, with very large companies committing to this sort of thing in practice and by example, have they merely been considering, or are they actually hiring to that degree?
I would say that in practice they've made open attempts that may have not been the right way to approach a group that you already don't represent. Nobody wants to be a statistic.
Sure.
By putting numbers out, you're not just saying you're now a statistic, but I don't think a lot of organizations thought it might be a deterrent. Right? You have people who are graduating from engineering programs that have vast opportunities. Stanford has, you know, a number of underrepresented graduates, and they have their choice of any place that they want to go. And diversity is also about being inclusive. If you put out numbers that say you're not included, how easy is it going to be to recruit people? It's not going to be. So I think part of it is, if they don't have pipeline to consider, they can't consider. And then, does somebody who's well qualified for the task want to go to a place where the only reason you're selecting them could potentially be because they're underrepresented, instead of for the talent that they have? And I think that's the bigger question, right? Is, are the commitments that they're making publicly helping or hurting them in their endeavors? And then second, if they do have pipeline and they are seeing these candidates, that's the number nobody gets to hear about. You hear about who's been hired, but you never listen to any company say, we had 1 million candidates apply. Out of those candidates, we considered 40% underrepresented. And then in terms of the qualifications across the board, we only had 10% be qualified, and we only had 2 positions open. Then that's a whole different ballpark. It's less about being underrepresented, and it's about selecting the best candidate for the role. But in this instance, that's not what anybody's talking about. We're talking about meeting quotas and numbers of employees, not level of talent and qualification of those employees in underrepresented classes. So I think, you know, we're talking about two very different things. I don't think their numbers say at all that, you know, they've truly considered it, but do we have visibility into the numbers that would allow for us to understand consideration? No. I think openly looking at pipeline numbers would be a better way to accommodate that and say, did you even consider people enough?
And in terms of the Rooney Rule, I mean, there's nobody's really checking on that. I mean, Facebook replaced someone on their board. They replaced a white man with another white man, and they didn't publicly say, hey, we considered all of these underrepresented minorities, and they just weren't qualified. I mean, is that the answer to just really say, like, here are all the people that were not qualified for this job that we hired?
No, I think it's more about inclusivity. Like, when you think about the numbers that they're putting out now, they're not saying, here's the 90%, you know, white, female, male, any population, and here's exactly who we rejected. What they're saying is here's who our employees are. Mm-hmm. On a board, it's a little bit of a tighter squeeze, right? But if you look at here's who we replaced and here's why, but also getting feedback from the candidates that they didn't select. A lot of organizations never say, and we consulted those that we did not have, or we have them as a consultancy. I've been asked the question a lot, you know, what are things we can do with the broken hiring practice? And part of it is leveraging the resources that help support that you do have that pipeline. If you're leveraging recruiting services that ensure that you have that capability, you don't have to vocalize it. They can for you. They can say that we sent along XYZ number of candidates which were considered for the position who had this number of qualifications. However, a different candidate was selected. And that's a third party. So it's not an internal bias that they're exposing. And I don't think I've seen anybody take advantage of that opportunity publicly from some of the larger organizations.
So asking candidates who turned down positions, why they didn't stay at certain positions, all that. Is there anything else that companies can do to do better at this?
Yeah, I would say the practice of inclusion. Initiatives they have merit, but if somebody told you, we're on an initiative to hire more women, would you like to apply for a job? Would you be like, wow, you just really considered everything and who I am?
Right,
no.
Right.
I mean, and that's what these initiatives are. Like, they're vocalization of, we are pointing you out and we need you, but you'll also still be in isolation because we're going to pre-group you. Mm-hmm. I think if you look at inclusivity, that's a whole different ballpark. Be honest and transparent about your practices and your goals. Be honest and transparent about the capabilities you need. If you actually listen to, you know, the way Amazon positioned it, and I think, Megan, you said it more delicately, if you look at a predominantly white board and then the board says, cards on the table, we don't have anybody here who fits our diversity strategy, and we want to ensure that we do. And in the past, we weren't good at this. So now here it is, public, laying it out on the table. We need more people who can help us make these diverse decisions. And it's part of our strategy and our advancement. That changes the dynamic of, this is a group of people pitted against you. Today, I work at G2 Crowd, and when I started, would I have said, hey, they were the epitome of diversity? No, I interviewed with three white men. I mean, but that's technology for a lot of people. But did I feel like I was excluded from the very beginning? Absolutely not. They promote inclusion through their website, their public voice. The way that the CEOs and the executives, I mean, our entire executive team and our board, the way that they carry themselves in public, the conversations that they keep outside of just work, and the relationships that they bear, all speak to how an organization includes. The numbers let you know they're not inclusive, initiatives let you know that they're boxing people into inclusion. But when you see diverse faces, not just people who are, you know, speaking because they're pushed to, but people who want to, right? I am on your show right now speaking about this because there are a lot of people who feel marginalized, but there are a lot of us who don't. There are a lot of inclusive cultures that openly in their vision statements let you know that transparency and diversity are part of what they want to promote. If you look at many of the organizations that are being considered and looked at around the Rooney Rule and by the Black Caucus, look at their vision and mission statements. Diversity is not always in them. That's not at the forefront of what they were trying to establish. So it's not part of the initial culture. So it's difficult to then change and challenge the culture that you began. But I think some organizations are taking steps in the right direction. But the real start is, like what the Black Caucus said, investing in your community programs. Each company is centered in a city that they build around them. It's their core area of recruitment for many of them. How many of the organizations that are looking at their numbers are also taking an active approach at investing in STEM programs, in sending the candidates that they do have that are of an underrepresented nature to different places to help expose the fact that it's not that you're not wanted and it's not that you're being boxed in. You have opportunity, because I do too. There's not really a lot of those opportunities being, you know, furnished for these organizations because they're not making that advanced step. But if you look at larger organizations, even in like construction, you send your construction foreman to different schools to recruit. And students look at people when they come in and look at your recruiter and decide, does this person look like me? Do they feel like me? Do I feel welcome in their presence? And you don't see that as part of a diversity initiative a lot of times. You don't see organizations representing that they're going to underrepresented and under, like, what do I want to say? Lower economic status locations and schools to represent opportunity. So where these underrepresented groups come from, you don't see a lot of investment. And if you want to invest in a future, you have to invest in the future, which is kids, STEM programs, college programs, scholarships focused on that level of diversity.
Jory, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us. I know you're busy and I really appreciate it. I know we had some technical difficulties, so I really appreciate you speaking to us and taking that time. Jory Ford is the Senior Director of Content for the G2 Crowd. Where is the best place for people to follow you or the G2 Crowd or both online?
So if anybody wants to follow me, the easiest place to go is on LinkedIn. It's LinkedIn in slash Chicago SEO Pro. And then if you want to follow us at G2 Crowd, we're on various channels. So I would say come to G2Crowd.com. Like us, share us, exactly as the image is showing.
Awesome. Thank you so much. It was great talking to you.
Fantastic.
Thank you, Megan. Thank you, Jason. I appreciate it.
It's time again for the Mary Meeker Trends Report, and Ronnie Mala from Recode read it all, so we don't have to. She's up next, but first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by LastPass. Keeps your passwords organized, secure, and right at your fingertips with LastPass. Whether it's managing your personal accounts or securing your workplace credentials, LastPass makes password security effortless. You just remember one master password, just one. Make it a good one, though, and LastPass will remember all the rest. LastPass generates and stores strong, unique passwords. Don't try to remember those passwords that they generate. You never will. You'll drive yourself crazy trying to memorize those passwords, and it doesn't matter because you don't have to. You are safe and secure. They will help you be safe and secure with those passwords, and they'll remember them. LastPass automatically remembers and then will fill in your passwords anytime, anywhere, whether you're on your computer or on your iPhone or your Android phone or your iPad or your tablet, no matter where you are, your Surface, it's all there. Add, view, and manage items that you've saved in the LastPass vaults. Over 81% of breaches are caused by weak passwords. You know the ones. Monkey, 123, password, but you change the O to a zero. You're not fooling anybody. Don't use those passwords. LastPass protects every password in your business without slowing down your employees. So if you have employees, make sure they're not using Monkey123. They might think it's great, but it's not. LastPass Enterprise simplifies password management for companies of every size with the tools you need to secure your business while centralizing control of employee passwords and all their apps. Set master password requirements, restrict access to specific devices and locations, mandate use of certain features. You get to decide. It has a lot more customization. Check it out. LastPass makes password sharing convenient for employees while keeping access to corporate data secure. Every employee has their own secure vault for managing passwords. Here's the even better part. Sensitive data is encrypted at the device level with AES 256 to protect from those nasty man-in-the-middle attacks. And LastPass has other products besides Enterprise for Business. There's LastPass Premium for personal use, LastPass Families for your entire family. All those kids reusing their passwords. Make them stop. LastPass Teams for teams of 50 or less. I've been using LastPass for years. It is such an improvement over remembering all those passwords, or more likely forgetting all of those passwords and having to waste all the time, you know, clicking that I forgot my password and then waiting for the email and then resetting it. Don't do that. You can waste the rest of your life doing that. You know what I'm talking about. I am constantly downloading new apps and services, and there isn't any way I could remember all of those passwords. And you know what else you don't want to do? Log in with Facebook. Don't do that either. It looks so easy. You just click that login for Facebook. I want to do it. No. Use LastPass. So you don't reuse all your good passwords. You only have to have one really, really good password, and then they'll make you change it too, because it's not good to keep the same password forever. Sorry. At work or at home, fix your password woes with LastPass, the number one most preferred password manager. Learn more at lastpass.com/twit today. I'm going to say it again. So if you didn't have your pencil ready, have your pencil ready. LastPass.com/twit, TWIT, and see which product is right for you.
Every year, Mary Meeker, venture capitalist and partner at Kleiner, Perkins, Caulfield, and Byers, releases a report that commands the attention of everyone in tech. The 2018 Internet Trends Report, all 294 slides of it, is out now and was presented on stage at the Code Conference earlier this week by Meeker herself. And joining us to talk about the report is Ronnie Mulla, who posted the first look at the report on Recode yesterday. Welcome to the show, Ronnie.
Thanks for having me, Jason and Megan.
Absolutely. It's great to get you here. So first, maybe we should take a little bit of a step back and kind of talk a little bit about the question of why this particular report is followed so closely. Year after year, it hits, everybody loses their mind on the internet and is sharing, you know, the facts and everything. Why is that?
So for a long time, Mary Meeker, as an analyst, she's had sort of like this Nostradamus ability to predict things. She, long before anyone else, was really behind Google and Amazon, and she predicted that, you know, these internet companies would be a big deal. And there's also how contained this is. She puts out, you know, 300 some slides some years, and it purports to gather all of the trends that are shaping the world, like the internet world. And there's also her delivery of it. It's sort of this deadpan, rapid fire, go through like hundreds of charts. Yeah, everyone loves it.
It's dizzying to watch all of that information. And, you know, some of it seems like, oh, yeah, that makes a whole lot of sense. Some of the pieces of information, it's almost like connecting the dots between all the things that we take for granted throughout the year. And then we begin to realize at a higher level why it's more important than maybe we first realized. So obviously with 294 slides this time around, it's absolutely impossible to tackle everything. But I thought maybe we could just kind of dive in and take a look at some of the big things that that Mary addressed in the report. First of all, she mentions something called the privacy paradox. Obviously, privacy, really big issue, really big hot button topic in technology right now. Explain what she means exactly by privacy paradox and why that's important.
Sure. She's referring to companies like Google and Facebook that are basically built off of advertising. And to make them better, to make their products better, and to make them as cheap as they are, free, essentially, they use our data. That's how they make money, is by doing whatever with our data and then getting advertisers to us. But at the same time, in order to make their products better, they take more data, and then our data is out there. And, you know, regulators are cracking down on that. They don't want, you know, we saw what happened with Cambridge Analytica, and we don't, a lot of people are being much more cautious about their privacy. So the paradox is that, you know, we want this, these products for free. They're based on advertising, but we don't want to give away our data for that advertising.
It's a no-win situation.
You mentioned Cambridge Analytica, and I didn't read the whole report or look at all the slides, but I did search for Facebook because it's kind of, you know, that's the big thing right now. And you write that that she didn't really say, basically what she said was, we're right in the middle of this right now. We don't really know which way this is going to go. What can you talk a little bit more about what if she gave us any clue to, like, are people using Facebook less because of this scandal, or do we not have any idea yet?
I don't think she really talked to that so much. One thing she did mention, which I think we might get to a little bit later, was just varying tolerances by people around the world to being able to give up their data. China, for example, people in China are much more amenable to sharing their data in exchange for a better experience, whereas in the US we're a bit more cautious. But she didn't really say one way or another, you know, what's going to happen with Facebook.
Yeah, she mentioned that China, you know, pointed out that China continuously is becoming more and more of a major hub for internet companies. We're seeing a lot more coming out of China. Does Meeker do any type of forward projections in these reports, or is it really just firmly planted in where we stand now? For example, like, you know, we've got this like looming trade war that, you know, continues to ramp up. How might that affect the growth of Chinese, you know, tech companies, internet companies in China versus the rest of the world versus here in the U.S.? Does she do any projections as far as that's concerned?
Well, her data normally stops, you know, in 2017, the year before. Right. But in a sense, she does, because she talks about China. You know, she mentions that it has the largest population of internet users. It's also, let's see, it's just such a big market. So you have to sort of look at China. So I guess that would be a sort of projection, you know, going forward. You know, they use so much data, they buy so much stuff on e-commerce there. It's only natural to take that as this is where things are going. Sure.
You pulled out an interesting fact. She said that it took Americans 80 years to accept the dishwasher. So if it feels like technology is moving faster than it ever has before, she says that's because it really is. Talk about that a little bit.
Oh, yeah. So she has this great slide where she shows how long it took Americans to adopt different technologies. And as you mentioned, the dishwasher took something like 80 years. And for the internet, the consumer internet, to sort of become just mainstream, it was less, more like 10 years. I think she's looking at when there's like 25% adoption or something like that. But yeah, the speed at which technologies are being adopted has increased vastly. So the next thing might move even faster.
Yeah, and it feels that way. It's dizzying at times. One technology that seems to be really slowing, and we've been so used to it being such a low, you know, a train moving at high speeds, and now it's slowed to a halt, is the smartphone market, of course. She talked about that a little bit in the report. Kind of seems like progress has stalled there. What does she have to share as far as that's concerned?
So she showed that there was, you know, 0% growth in smartphone shipments this year, which it's important to say that plenty of people are buying smartphones. It's just the market it's not accelerating. It has slowed down. We're nearing saturation. A lot of the world is connected. A lot of the world already has a smartphone. So you're not going to see that sort of growth that when we didn't have a smartphone, and then you get it, and then you get these percentage point growth. You know, we're at 0% now, but it's still huge. We still buy cell phones every few years, even in mature markets like the United States. So I don't think that's to say that, you know, smartphones are going anywhere. It's just that's not where the growth is.
One of the things that I feel like sort of came out of nowhere, and I don't even think that she really noticed or thought that it was coming, was the Amazon Echo. It became popular really quickly and no one necessarily saw it coming. Did she say anything about the state of voice assistants like the Echo and the Google Home?
Yeah, she pointed to the really rapid adoption of those. I forget the statistic on it, but one quarter, it was like 20 million people were using it. And then the next quarter, there was 30 million. So this is really, really rapid growth. I think as far as she mentioned it, I believe, as far as commerce, people purchasing through things through their Echoes or their Google Homes. So I think we're going to start seeing a lot more of that sort of stuff. Voice retail, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Amazon came up time and time again in this report, just driving that point home, just how important to modern day technology and the internet and commerce and so many facets that Amazon is firmly implanted in right now. What, just as an overarching kind of theme from this report, what really stood out to you on a personal level? What do you think was some of the more valuable pieces of information?
Well, just to continue on the Amazon stuff, I thought that was really interesting. She had one stat that was like 50% almost of U.S. consumers, when they try to buy something online, they go through Amazon. And that means they're not going through, I think 36% of the time they were going through Google or Safari. So Amazon is very much like the front door to e-commerce in the United States.
Big time.
And then also she'd said something about how Amazon also is moving into advertising. We normally thought of that as the province of Google and Facebook, and Amazon sold things online and was a platform for selling things, but now it's also turning into a major advertiser.
Sure.
But I guess as far as other things that really stuck out to me, she talks a bit about the on-demand economy, about how the future of work is going to be much more freelance and much more on demand. She, I believe, framed it as like having more freedom to, choose when you work, but also that comes with a bunch of downsides. You don't necessarily get health insurance or, no one's there if you get fired. It's sort of, it's a contract job. So I thought of that as a little maybe depressing.
Yeah, but the structure of our lives, if we're working in these on-demand jobs, have other associated benefits. But, it's just different.
Sure.
So incredibly different from what we've been used to the last however many decades. And then, of course, Code Conference, there were a lot of interviews. Anything in particular that you think people who may have missed some of the coverage from the Code Conference should definitely check out? What were you guys most excited about from the conference?
I think the interview I enjoyed the most was Kara interviewed Evan Spiegel, Snapchat founder, and she was very tough on him. She asked him what it would be like, what it was like to have Facebook kind of copy all of your stuff, and whether that was a big deal to him, and also much more hard-hitting questions about, them making money and their transparency with shareholders. These interviewing a CEO or some major executive, they're often very polished, and this is their job not to answer questions. It almost felt like he was being authentic. I know that's probably like the dream PR is that he's like being authentic, but he's doesn't really say anything too revealing. But I thought it was a really excellent interview. He had a good comeback about Facebook stealing copying all of their ideas. He said something to the effect of, "I wish they'd copy our data privacy rules as well."
Right. Ooh, stinger.
Sick burn.
Yeah.
In the tech world, yeah.
Yeah, right. Ronnie Mola from Recode, we really appreciate you taking time to talk with us about this. Thank you for joining us.
Me.
Where can people follow your work online?
You could follow me at recode.net or at Ronnie Mola on Twitter.
Awesome. Thank you, Ronnie. We'll talk to you soon. Have a good night. All right, there's another trend that never seems to go away, and that's online fraud. There are just so many ways for someone to fall into a trap and not even realize what they've done until it's too late. That's what online fraudsters bank on, after all. Joining us to talk about the state of internet fraud in 2018 is John Breo, who is the VP of Public Policy, Telecommunications, and Fraud with the National Consumers League. Welcome to the show, John.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Jason. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, it's great to get you on. So first, I had originally run across an article on NBC News that talked about typo squatting. That's a phenomenon that isn't necessarily new on the internet, but it's worth reminding people about. And I had never actually heard that as a particular terminology for this. So I guess let's start there. Talk a little bit about what typo squatting is exactly and how that can lead to some fraud online.
Sure. So typo squatting is basically a type of fraud where scammers will register a domain name that is close on the keyboard to popular. For example, they may use something like ESPN.cm, or they may take Facebook and take out the O and have Facebook .cm or something like that. And basically what they're relying on is for consumers who are typing quickly to actually put in the wrong address, and instead of getting sent to the place they're trying to get to, Facebook or Netflix or their bank's website, they go to one of these typo squatting sites. And what's dangerous for consumers is that when they get to those sites, they can be designed to look just like where you thought you were trying to go to. So the consumer, unaware that they are actually on a scam site, could put in personal information like a bank account number or a username and password combination, and end up giving that to the scammer. We've seen other instances where when the consumer goes to the website, they get faced with pop-up things like your computer is infected. Click here to download antivirus or something like that. And instead of downloading antivirus, what you're actually downloading is malware that does things like install keyloggers on your computer. So it's a nasty type of scam. It's certainly one that's been around for a long time. But I think what perked our interest was some new research that came out recently that talked about just how frequently consumers go to these sites. So, you know, the Krebs on Security is a great blog that talks about this. The research they put out said that consumers have visited typo squatting sites 12 million times in the first 3 months of 2018. And so that's what sort of got our interest. And we wanted to help spread the word because, you know, these old scams, you know, we know what the old saying is, like, there's nothing new under the sun. Well, the same happens when you're talking about scams as well. Old scams get refreshed, get updated, and a whole new batch of consumers that may have I never heard of this in the first place or may have heard about this when they first were started using the internet, but then thought it got fixed, end up falling victim to it again. So that's why we are doing a fraud alert about it, not only to make consumers aware that the scam is still out there, but also to give them tips for avoiding it.
And the same can be said about, you know, apps that look like popular apps. You'll find that a lot too, right? Like, you know, if an app becomes suddenly really popular, you'll search the app store and there'll be many things that are like that. I know that happened with like a Bitcoin wallet recently. Have you seen that a lot as well?
Yeah, certainly. You know, the lookalike apps is a problem as well. You know, clearly consumers can download them and ended up getting scammed. I think where we're seeing the most concern, at least from researchers who are looking at this, is the type of squatting websites. Because those could, you know, those are not ones that Google or Apple can take off the off of their app store when they get complaints. Those are ones that stay around for a while. And certainly some of the bigger names out there, as part of their general information security programs, will go out and actually register those lookalike domains as much as possible. But they can't do everything. And at the end of the day, it comes down to consumers who actually take steps to try and minimize their risk.
Now, fraud.org, which is a site that's managed by the National Consumers League, which you work for, you post, I guess every year you're posting kind of the top scams of the year. I saw one for 2016, saw one for 2017. I realize we're only a few months into 2018 at this point. Actually now five, almost six. This year's going by pretty fast. Anyways, what have you seen so far? Like what are some, aside from typo squatting, I mean, is it usually just the same things, like you said, kind of bubbling up to the surface again? Or are there any unique trends that are happening right now?
Yeah, there are two in particular that I think, you know, we're keeping an eye on. One is not a specific scam per se, but it's how scammers are asking to be paid. So it used to be that when you fell victim to a scam, chances are that the scammer was going to tell you to go and wire money via Western Union or MoneyGram or something like that. Later on, they got a little smarter and they started asking you to put money onto prepaid money pack cards from Green Dot or similar cards like that. What we're monitoring now is that the scammers are asking their victims to actually go out and put money onto gift cards. So for a while, the iTunes cards were a popular form of payment. You'll see ones now where it's sort of the Amazon gift cards. And what they're doing is really trying to get the consumer, the victim of the scam, to give them the code off of the back of that card. And once they give the code, the scammer can quickly get the funds off of the card and use it to purchase merchandise that they will send through a drop shipment a scam of some sort. Or sometimes they'll even just sell the codes themselves on the dark web. We found that the iTunes codes in particular we were hearing were big among gamers in China. So that was that's certainly something we continue to keep our eye on. Another scam that we're actually going to do alert about tomorrow is a scam targeting people selling merchandise online, like through Craigslist or on eBay. And what's happening is, let's say you're selling a diamond ring or a wedding dress or some other high-value piece of merchandise. You'll find a buyer. They'll ask you to ship it to them. You'll ship it, send them the shipping code info, and they will send you back a spoofed email that looks like it's coming from PayPal. And in fact, they say the funds will be released once the merchandise arrives. But in fact, the email is fake. PayPal is not at all involved in this. And the scammer gets valuable merchandise paying nothing for it. And so the consumer is left high and dry. We've seen the rate at which we're receiving complaints about that particular type of scam double in the first part of 2018 versus what it was in 2017. So we're trying to get the word out to consumers to be aware of this, particularly if they are trying to sell merch online.
So, like you said, there's no new scams. And I think traditionally scammers try to take advantage of us, you know, either like we want a free lunch or we feel like we want to help. Like, that's a big one. I know it's hurricane season and a lot of places in the U.S. Last year in Santa Rosa where we live, there were fires. What can people do? Because I know that's a big time for scammers to have fake donation sites. What can people do if they want? How can they tell what the real donation sites are? And the same with like GoFundMes. What are some tips on people who want to donate but they don't want to be scammed?
Sure. The safest way to donate and avoid these charity scams is to go to a reputable charity on your own. Type that web address into your browser and surf there on your own. Don't trust links you get through unsolicited emails or that you may see on popular social media sites like Instagram or Facebook or Twitter. Those can often redirect you to lookalike sites that may look like Red Cross or another well-known charity, or they may redirect you to a charity you never heard of, but maybe that has an appealing-looking website. Consumers should also make sure that check out a charity before they donate. There are sites out there from folks like the Better Business Bureau who have a program called the Wise Giving Alliance. That you can check out the reputation of a particular charity. Charity Navigator is another good one. GuideStar is another good way to vet those charities before you donate. And so make sure that, you know, it's a legit charity that actually has a real address. You know, just be careful, particularly about putting in credit card information when you get those unsolicited emails. As you mentioned, we see this all the time around hurricane season. We've seen it after. We see this after practically any natural disasters. We saw them pop up after school shootings, like Sandy Hook in particular. There were several that popped up. So, basically, these scammers are preying on consumers' desire to help. It's a good human trait that we want to give when people are in need. Unfortunately, there are scammers out there that all too often are preying on people's generosity.
Yeah, absolutely. And so many other things. And finally, you advocate before Congress and pushing for stronger consumer protections in many of these areas, more. But I'm sure you would probably agree that there's a lot of change that seems to be happening, siding less with consumer protection in many ways. Net neutrality could be one example of those. What are your thoughts on the work that you're doing in Congress in today's political climate? Has it gotten a lot more difficult?
Well, you know, in the consumer advocacy world, we talk about playing offense or playing defense. So I don't think there's any question that for folks like me who want more consumer protections out there, we're definitely playing defense in this environment. That said, there are opportunities, I think, to get protections out there, to get some wins on the board. You saw that recently when the Senate passed its CRA to try and roll back the FCC's net neutrality regulations. That effort is right now in the House, where its fate is uncertain. But certainly it's an example of what can be done, even in a difficult political climate, to try and move the needle in favor of consumer protection. But it's not easy. I think that's why groups like mine are, frankly, looking for issues that may be bubbling up under the radar that we can advocate on. Data security is one that's certainly, I think, an area that there may be obvious around, because whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, if your data gets hacked in a breach, you're going to be more vulnerable. So I think that there's opportunities for Congress to move in that area. The states are doing a lot of work. So even if, the issue that you care about, like net neutrality, for example, or privacy, doesn't look like it's going anywhere in Congress, there's a lot of activity at the state level that's going on.
That's absolutely true. I just saw the other day, California as well, kind of on that train. So
yeah, you've got a ballot initiative there on privacy that I think is making a lot of news.
Yeah. Yeah. Good news hidden within some of the not so good news. John Breo, really appreciate you coming on the show and sharing your insights on all of this. It's super important work. Tell people where you would like them to go to learn more about the work you guys are doing.
Sure. So, we are NCL is actually a over 118-year-old consumer advocacy group. We do work on everything from safe food and drug to child labor to healthcare. And then there's sort of what my department does. And I only have to openly say that sort of we do everything else. But some of the things we're working on right now is, for example, looking at all the fees that you pay when you buy a ticket to a sporting event or a concert. Mm-hmm. Those don't make any sense. Consumers hate them. And they only exist because one large company, Ticketmaster, has a stranglehold on the industry. We're also looking at sort of all those fees that you pay when you fly. There's a big bill coming up in Congress to reauthorize the FAA. So if you hate fees, come let us know, and we're happy to carry your stories to Congress. That we're always fighting scams and trying to keep consumers safe. So a particular pyramid scheme is one we're working on right now. And of course, all the stuff I just talked about, data security, privacy, the open internet. Those are all issues that we try and tackle every day here at NCL.
Awesome. And that's nclnet.org. Is that right?
That's right. That's our main website. Folks can also find us at www.fraud.org. We also are on Twitter at @NCL_tweets. And they can find me personally at Jamming Econo.
Right on. John, appreciate your time. Thank you so much, and keep up the good work. And we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Have a good evening.
Bye.
All right, and finally, I thought we'd end this show by actually taking a look at what I got from Amazon. You want to see? I got shipped something. You want to see what it is?
I do, because you wouldn't show me before the show. I wanted to know.
I'm pretty surprised you didn't know, because had you looked at my Twitter feed, you would have figured it out.
Sorry,
but I'm happy that you didn't, because it could be a nice surprise. What do you think's in here, Megan?
A Wickedly Prime. It looks like stuff that someone with a peanut allergy would not like.
Okay, all right. That's
which
good.
Which is Kevin.
It could 50 be 50 steaks. Okay.
Well, wicked. Is it? I don't know.
Yeah, for the audio listeners, I will just say this is a pretty large box, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know how large exactly, but it's pretty gigantic. So we'll go ahead. I'm going to recreate what I experienced earlier today. I did actually record video of it, so if you really want, you can actually watch it in 3D. So I'll go ahead.
Wait, did you know? Was this a surprise?
I only knew about half. I only knew when I lifted up one flap and checked how heavy this was, exactly what was inside. Prior to that, I thought it was like something that my wife. Well, it is on the table. Oh, the packaging. Well, that makes sense. Here. Okay, we'll go ahead and throw the packaging out there.
What? Did you order this?
Okay. I did.
Oh, okay. Were you drunk when you ordered it?
No.
Okay.
I wasn't. I was very innocent. Here, we'll just keep pulling that out there.
Because, I mean, okay. I don't know. I've heard that some people do that.
Okay. There. And at the bottom of the box... Oh. It's a package of Oreo cookies. Have you ever gotten this much packaging to ship a single package of Oreo cookies?
No, but to be fair, you've received many packages of Oreo cookies that have been crushed by the time they got here. Also, that's not even a regular size package of Oreos. That's small. How many?
No, this is a regular size.
Aren't they long?
No, this is a regular size.
No, usually they're long. Usually they're two rows. That maybe is three rows.
This is three rows. Yeah.
Usually they're standard size Oreos is two long rows. Am I right?
I don't know. I think you need to check the net weight. This is 10.7 ounces, but you're missing the point. That is not the point. This box is not needed to ship this tiny little thing of Oreo cookies. Am I right?
Well, you should stop using Amazon and all Amazon products.
I went to the store and they were sold out. So I had to order. I had to order on Amazon. They didn't have kettle corn Oreos. And I'm sorry that it's kettle corn Oreos because these are probably disgusting, but I'm doing it for All About Android.
Let me see those. Here. My Oreo creation.
Yes, these are the special flavors
it
that they have.
It has puffed millet pieces. In it.
Yeah, and I'm probably not going to like that all that millet.
I thought it was going to be, like, it says Wickedly Prime. What's Wickedly Prime? I thought that was a special Prime things where all the food is...
I think it's just Prime Pantry is what it was.
Oh.
Because I went to the store and they were sold out. And we were going to do this on Tuesdays, All About Android, because we taste a new flavor of Oreo every week. And they didn't have it at the store. And so Ron just sent me an Amazon link. He's like, here, just order it and we'll have it for next week. Which I did. I never in a million years thought that it would be shipped in a box this big with all of this plastic. This is irresponsible, Amazon.
Well, there's something that's really disturbing about Amazon packaging, and it concerns us all. Because most of us order things from Amazon. I tried to give up Amazon. I couldn't do it.
Yeah.
I order a lot of things that I could get at the store, and there's some reason why I don't. And you remember, like, a few months ago where there was that urban legend that Amazon packs its... trucks according to like an algorithm that like they need to fit like,
yes, and some people in my Twitter feed were like, oh well, this is why it's
but that's
like that.
Not true.
Okay, so
like,
it's an urban legend.
No, that is an urban legend, but it's a fascinating urban legend because we really want to have a reason why, like, we don't want it to be random. We need to know why Amazon does that, so we'll make up something and then spread it.
Yeah,
but that's not true. That's been proven wrong. So
okay. Good. I'm happy to hear you say that. I would love
Burke
to read up about
it. Burke says it's partially true. What part of it is true?
You need to pack them as efficiently as possible. Whatever's in them, right? There's no precognition about... Well,
it's a precog. That's what we're going to blame. Yeah. Blame the precogs.
We have one final order to fit in this truck. It just came through. It's kettle corn Oreo. But we need to fill this much space.
Yeah, actually, yeah. I would like to believe it's the precogs that pack the Amazon...
oh my goodness.
Trucks. It is really ridiculous. But, I mean, like I said, you have gotten Oreos that are crushed.
I have, but I would be okay with that versus this.
Mm-hmm.
This seems over. This just seems wrong. What's that?
The crushed ones were
yes.
Way better.
They just happen to be old and possibly used Oreo cookies. Yeah, you know. Of all people, I thought we're going to be just as upset as I am.
I'm upset about it. Somebody in the chat room, it's now scrolled through, so I don't know who made the suggestion, but you can provide feedback.
I will.
Not just mentioning it on Twitter and on a podcast.
Yeah, I've got things in the works. things in the works. That's
I think,
that's
yeah,
all I could say.
Loquacious, thank you, said that.
No, it's true. It's true. When that happens, I mean, and I've got it all documented. I've got a video of the unboxing because I thought it was ridiculous, pictures of it. So it's easy for me to send it to Amazon and be like, so do you see something wrong with this picture? Because I don't know. But hey,
no, I'm upset. I'm just as upset as you are.
Hey, maybe that's what I get for shopping from Amazon. Maybe that's my lesson learned, is that I shouldn't do that. But it was the most convenient thing considering they were sold out. I did what I thought I had to do. Feel bad for me.
I do. Okay. I do. It's really, that is really the worst thing to happen to anyone.
Yeah, today. Especially when, yes. Oh, bad. It's the worst. No, I think maybe this flavor might be the worst thing to happen to anyone.
I'm going
to
try it. Obviously, we have to wait until Tuesday, yes. But.
Tuesday. We'll try eat this and see how it goes.
Unless Burke has his hand that he, his mechanical hand that steals
little
the
hand.
Oreos.
Yeah. Yeah. He does that every week now. It's a thing.
I want to use it right now.
Tech News Weekly records live every Thursday, 2:30 p.m. No little hands. No, oh, man, it's happening. Every Thursday at 2:30 p.m. Pacific at twit.tv/live. You can be part of the show by emailing us at tnw@twit.tv.
With the Oreo.
Get away, get away, little hand. This is not for you.
Okay, sorry. Oh.
This is not for you, little hand.
Subscribe to our show at twit.tv/TNW. If you want to tweet at me, I'm at Megan Maroney.
I'm at Jason Howell. I'm not doing that. Megan's doing that to herself. I just want, for the record.
Jason, stop.
Thanks to our technical director, Josh. Thanks to Burke for the little hand. Thanks to Jammer B for the little hand, too. And Colleen, everybody that helps out on this show each and every week. And thanks to you. We'll see you next time on another episode of Tech News Weekly. Bye, everybody.